I am the Martian ambassador. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
You know, that's just like your opinion, man.
It's time for Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of d-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host, and with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Robin.
Hello.
And TK.
Hello.
It is with great sadness that we gather here once again to mourn the passing of some noteworthy, nay, legendary actors. For since we last recorded an episode of this podcast, Sir Roger Moore, Powers Booth, and Michael Parks have all passed away. Usually when a noteworthy celebrity dies, we like to dedicate a full episode to them. But in this case, we intend to pay tribute to all three of these men on this episode as we discuss Moore, Booth, and Parks. We'll list our favorite of their roles and compare three very different careers in film and television right after this. Back Row is dedicated to delivering free entertainment to everyone in the forms of media culture blogging, movie reviews, short films, podcasts, and more. That's awesome, I hear you say, and you're right, it is pretty awesome. So why don't you help us out by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes and leaving a review? Search the iTunes store for Shouts from the Back Row to subscribe to our feed, and if you're feeling generous, visit the-back-row.com and click the donate button to send us a few bucks. Your support means the world to us. We'd like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and just about everything else we've been doing. So, TK, what have you been up to?
I haven't been up to a whole lot, but Samurai Jack's done, guys. Done.
It's over.
It's over. Gil, have you had a chance to watch? Sure.
Yeah, I'm all caught up.
Yeah, and that's... I finished the episode and thought, you know, that was how it should have gone, I think. Like, I don't think there was any way to finish the show in any other fashion. I was especially excited to see the characters from my favorite episode, Jump Good, come back.
That's your favorite episode?
That's the one I talk most animatedly about. I really think that episode is fantastic. I was waiting because they had an episode like I think 4 or 5 episodes ago where they're showing a whole bunch of Jack's old friends as Aki is trying to find him, right? And the Jump Good guys weren't in that, and I was super pissed off, and I was so happy when they showed up at the end there. It was a good climactic battle, some beautiful animation, and I think a perfectly good closing arc to the Samurai Jack. I was very happy with this 5th season, and I had a lot of fun watching it, and just kind of upset it's all gone.
Yeah,
how'd you feel about it, Gil?
I really cannot wait to see what Genndy Tartakovsky does next, because this was, I think, some of the best work he has ever done. He's working in just high definition, but using that classic Samurai Jack style, which is this sort of, it's this painted look that has no hard outline to the characters. There's no black outline on any of them. And combined with Tartakovsky's distinctive, like, angular drawing style, it's just absolutely gorgeous. And I've always thought that every frame of Samurai Jack is a work of art. So to see him operating in high definition, it was totally beautiful and wonderful. And then, you know, as I think I mentioned it on the podcast when that episode you were talking about happened, sort of a recap where we meet all the people Jack has helped over the years. During that episode, one of my favorite things about it was just being able to see all those characters and locations rendered again in high definition and, like, such extreme clarity and in a widescreen display, because at the time Samurai Jack was airing, it was still square-shaped TV screens, 4:3 aspect ratio. So it was a real joy to see all of those characters come back in the finale as well. But for me, and this isn't a big spoiler because it happens, it's literally the first thing that happens in the episode, I think the best thing about it was getting to see the whole intro once again, the whole thing, you know, long ago in a distant land, that whole intro from the older series, not the new series, seeing that again to cap off the story was just so perfect. Because, of course, that intro is a recap of the premise of Samurai Jack. So bringing it back and just saying, like, this is what you're about, this is the story that you are about to see the conclusion of, it really made me so happy. And yeah, the big battle was extremely satisfying, really lived up to everything, and it had this nice sort of bittersweet ending as, in my opinion, one of the best animated series ever concluded. It's one of my all-time favorites. So, no more Samurai Jack, but I just can't wait to see what Tartakovsky follows this up with.
Yeah, and that's about where I am, too. And like I said, I had a blast watching this fifth season. It made me revisit a bunch of old episodes, and it was I just had a lot of fun with it. And other than that, that's all I've been up to. What have you guys been doing?
Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, I'm going to start off by talking about Alien Covenant, which I saw this week. And I would probably rank this somewhere in the middle of the Alien series. I would probably rank it ahead of Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, and Prometheus, but still far down from Alien and Aliens. It was an enjoyable enough sci-fi movie. It did a lot to recapture the spirit of the original Alien, but it did have some draggy spots. But when it actually had the alien attacks happen, it was quite effective, I thought. I thought they were really, like, well-directed. I think the biggest flaw with this movie is that, with one notable exception, most of the characters are pretty boring, just kind of stock, one-dimensional characters. I thought that Catherine Waterston's heroine in it was pretty boring, and that's kind of the thing with these later Alien movies, is like, you can remember like the names of all the characters in Alien and Aliens because they were so distinct and entertaining, but the last several is just, they're pretty forgettable. But the one notable exception, though, is Michael Fassbender, and I'll say that if you are a Michael Fassbender fanboy, you might find this to be the greatest movie ever made.
OTK, oh boy, oh boy.
Oh boy, I mean.
Yes. I'm surprised you haven't seen it yet, quite frankly, considering all the Fassbender in this, because not only does he play one clone, he plays two clones. He plays a new clone named Walter, a new android, and David from Prometheus. And there are a lot of scenes of Fassbender acting with Fassbender, having conversations with each other. There's even a scene of Fassbender fighting Fassbender, and one moment where Fassbender kisses Fassbender. So,
sounds like this movie could be called Too Fast, Too Furious.
Yes, Too Fassbender, Too Furious. I think TK has fainted right now, so
he's yeah, he's silent. Dead silent. Are you
I'm so excited.
And I think he pretty much single-handedly saves the movie because he is so entertaining in all of his roles and playing these two distinct, like, android characters and stuff. So whenever he's on screen, the movie perks up, even though the other characters are kind of dull. So he pretty much steals the movie, and I would gladly watch more Alien movies if they keep bringing him back, because he's definitely the highlight. So I definitely would give this a mild thumbs up. It's an entertaining movie overall, but I wouldn't rank it as a classic or anything.
Very interesting. I've been hearing that the characters are all really stupid, and that is a real detriment to the film.
That is true, yes. Not only are they dull, but they make a lot of stupid mistakes in this one.
Yeah, I was, in listening to reviews of Alien Covenant, I was reminded of my own review of that movie Life with Ryan Reynolds and Jake Gyllenhaal and Rebecca Ferguson, where I was talking about how, you know, these people are scientists, they're supposed to be a little smarter, but the first thing that they always do is get right up close to an alien life form so that it can attack them. And from what I hear, that definitely happens in Alien Covenant as well. Alas.
It's true. It's true. There's nobody who tries to outrun in a straight line, like in Prometheus at least, but they still make tons of mistakes in this one. As far as what else I've been seeing, I finally did see Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and not much more that I can add that you guys haven't already said. It was an enjoyable enough time, probably not as good as the original, but still I felt more fresh than a lot of the other recent Marvel outings. I guess it's because, like, when it came out in 2014, the original, it was such a breath of fresh air, whereas the sequel, it's kind of rehashing, like, the same type of quirky humor and stuff, but it is still entertaining to watch, and it is really visually striking, really good looking. I would almost recommend watching this one in 3D because I think the visuals are pretty spectacular. And great role for Kurt Russell. I liked bringing him in there as Quill's dad. He was very entertaining. And another thing I liked is a bigger role for Michael Rooker in this one. I was kind of pleasantly surprised. They kind of go more in depth into his character, so I was happy to see him get more screen time and almost steal the movie whenever he was on screen. So yeah, it doesn't break any new ground, but I had a decent enough time, fun enough time watching it.
As I noted in my review of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, my initial thoughts coming out of the theater were just like that. It was like, you know, this is, it doesn't feel as fresh as the first one, not quite as good, but I, just to echo what I said before, because it still remains true, the movie actually has really stuck with me. I've been listening to the soundtrack all the time, especially at work, like while I'm working on graphic design stuff. I just love the soundtrack lineup. It's a lot more sort of groovy, bittersweet songs. And upon reflection as well, I was thinking about how much I appreciated Michael Rooker in this. You know, he's a character actor who's been in so many different kind of pulpy things and like The Walking Dead. He's always playing these scumbags, but he actually was given a really great role in Yondu where he gets to, he can be menacing, he can be threatening, but he can also be like genuinely emotional and extremely funny. I think his best line in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is where he's hanging on to his floating arrow as he sort of lowers himself onto the ground, and I forget who it is. It might be Peter Quill who says, "You look like Mary Poppins," and he goes, "Is he cool?" Yeah, Mary Poppins is cool. I'm Mary Poppins, y'all. It's just,
that was awesome.
It was great. It was a great moment. And one more thing that actually occurred to me regarding Michael Rooker is I was at the grocery store the other day, and I saw a bag of Doritos with Michael Rooker on it. Man, that is weird. Yeah. Isn't that weird?
Yes. Never expected to see Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer on a bag of Doritos, so he's come a long way. That's pretty awesome. But yeah, he's been working with James Gunn like since the beginning because he had a big role in Slither as well. So it's kind of nice to see him get rewarded with a much more substantial role here. And I would gladly watch more Guardians movies as they come along. It's a pretty entertaining series. And what else I've been up to, I finally gotten into the new true crime Netflix series, The Keepers, and pretty much binged the whole thing in one weekend. And I'd say it is a very well-made and, like, very enthralling documentary, but it's also very frustrating because when it's over, I honestly can say I have no idea what happened. I would not be able to come up with a concrete theory to figure out who the killer is in this particular one. If you're not familiar with the story, it's about a murder of a nun named Sister Kathy Sesnick way back in Baltimore in 1969. And it was eventually revealed that she worked at like a Catholic school where the head priest and some of the other priests and some of their friends were sexually abusing the students. And it's suspected that she was killed because she may have found out about it and was murdered to silence her. And it's strange because a lot of the advertising makes it sound like a murder mystery whodunit, but there are entire episodes where they focus on the sexual abuse and the cover-ups by the Catholic Church. It's kind of reminiscent of Spotlight. And there are actually a few episodes where you completely forget about Sister Kathy. You just focus on the victims, revealing what happened to them and the abuse they suffered and the lawsuits against the church. So it does kind of feel disjointed at times because it'll go from sexual abuse to murder, and then it'll go in one direction where you think you know who the killer is, but then introduce like a whole bunch of new suspects and a whole bunch of new angles. And there are times when like they introduce plot threads that kind of get dropped when it's over, and then when you're done watching the movie, you're like, oh yeah, what about that guy? Whatever happened to him? And it also in the first episode brings up the murder of another woman who was killed in Baltimore during the time period, and then kind of forgets about her to the last episode till they kind of bring her up again, and you're left wondering, so how does her murder fit into this as all? So it's such a major rabbit hole, so I was enthralled by it, and instantly as I was over, I was kind of going on the internet and trying to research and trying to figure out what happened, but I still couldn't tell you because the story is just so convoluted, and once you start watching, you won't want to stop, and it's best to watch this as a binge watch, just so that you're not lost by all the different story threads and all the different characters and all the different theories that happen. So, and who knows, even though this case is now like over 40, 45 years old, who knows if this series will help get it solved after all these years because of all the new exposure it gets. But it was right up my alley, and I can tell you, as a true crime buff, to definitely check out The Keepers on Netflix. Once you start, you will not want to stop.
True crime, so hot right now.
Exactly. And speaking of which, I happen to host a very hot podcast right now called The Trail Went Cold. And this week I released a new episode. It's actually a Canadian-themed episode about two young men who were murdered back in 1967. And their bodies were not identified until 40 years later. And what's notable here is that one of the murders took place in a town called Schaumburg, which is only about a half an hour drive away from Orangeville, where I grew up. It's a village that I've driven through several times during my childhood, and I had no idea that there was an unsolved mystery associated with it. So this one hit pretty close to home. So be sure to check it out, because we haven't done a Canadian mystery in a long time on The Trail Went Cold. And I also want to remind you that it's only 2 weeks from now that I'm going to be at CrimeCon in Indianapolis representing The Trail Went Cold on Podcast Row. And I'm also get to host a private party with some of my listeners, and I've got tentative plans now to do a live reading of a minisode at that party before it gets released, and it's going to be a minisode about an unsolved murder that took place at an Indianapolis hotel during the 1940s. So I don't know if any of you listening will be in Indianapolis for CrimeCon, but if you are, come say hi to me, and I would hope to have you join me at my party to see me do my very first live read through.
You guys, Robin's famous. You have
it's
it on
true.
Record. Robin is famous, and he's taken us with him to fame. That is so
exactly.
Awesome, man. Congratulations on winning that contest and getting the party and everything. That's so cool.
Yes, thank you very much. It was unexpected. If you don't know the story, they were holding a contest where the podcast which had the most listeners use a specialized promo code to order tickets to PrimeCon would get awarded a private party for themselves and for their listeners. And I didn't expect to win, because I didn't get added to the lineup until like very late, besides the other podcast, but surprisingly I did, so I get to have a private party, so pretty exciting. People order tickets just to come see me. I am famous. So, and yeah, that's about all I've been up to.
So besides Samurai Jack, I have also been watching American Gods, and TK, have you been watching American Gods? I can't remember.
I haven't seen an episode yet, and I need to remedy that fairly quickly.
Oh man, so I really want to know your thoughts on this, buddy, because I'm three episodes of four, and I'm certainly enjoying it, and it is, as most Brian Fuller things, especially Hannibal, Brian Fuller's previous series, it is, like, totally gorgeous to look at, but I don't feel like this show has really found its footing quite yet. I mean, maybe episode three got a little bit better with its sort of almost like three short stories style, but while I'm watching American Gods, I either find myself wondering, would this make sense to someone who hasn't read the book? And sometimes also, what the hell is going on? Because it's so surreal and avant-garde and scattershot that there are definitely times where I think, like, okay, I can see what's happening in this scene, but how does it relate to the rest of this story? Even knowing the book, I sort of go like, okay, so, for example, it's like, oh, okay, so this guy, this random salesman has met a kind of a genie who's working as a cab driver, and they have sex, and that's it. We don't really know the names of either of these characters. We've never seen them before. This like 10-minute vignette, but like where is this going? How does this all fit together? It's been renewed for a second season, so we're guaranteed two seasons of American Gods. I'm gonna keep watching it because I like the book, And as I said, as someone who has read the book, I do understand most of what's going on in the show, and because I know, you know, certain things that are revealed later on, I can appreciate them now, but I'm just so curious to get more opinions on this. Not a lot of my friends are watching American Gods, and I'm so curious what other people think, because I still don't quite know what to make of it. And I've watched 3 hours of this thing. But I do know that it's perfectly cast. Peter Stormare, in particular, is, like, stealing every scene he's in recent episodes. But is it, I don't know, is it cohesive? Is it coherent? I need more opinions. American Gods. I guess I'm, like, somewhere in the middle. It has its goods, and it has its bads. And then the other thing that I watched recently is I watched T2 Trainspotting, the belated sequel to a movie that did it ever need a sequel? Was anybody like, you know what, I really want to see more Trainspotting? It seemed like such a confusing follow-up to do 20 years later. And apparently it's not quite based on the follow-up novel by Irvin Walsh. So I don't really know where this story was pulled from. But it is neat to see all the cast reprising their roles, and it felt like it wasn't unnecessary, which was interesting to me. So many of these lengthy sequels that we're getting, either a belated sequel or something like Alien Covenant, where it's like a series that's been just going on forever, so many of these sequels just don't feel like they can justify themselves. But at the very least, Trainspotting 2 felt like it had a few things to say about, like, midlife crises, and what it's like to grow up, you know? Here are these guys who, when they were really young, like early 20s, they were complete junkies, and when you're in your early 20s, you can have that sort of anarchic streak where you're just, like, jaded with the world, and it's all very punk to live in squalor and blah-de-blah-de-blah. So it's interesting to see those same characters return, and they've all sort of grown up to some degree. Like, they're all still really immature, but they're having to cope with the fact that they are older, and they're old men now, and a few of them have kids. So they're struggling with adulthood and trying to figure out what they're doing with their lives. And it's an interesting meditation on that idea, but it doesn't feel anywhere near as fresh or edgy or anarchic or bombastic as the original Trainspotting. There are these glimmers of that old Danny Boyle genius. There are these moments where you're presented with a really cool visual, or the characters have a particularly great monologue that just feels so full of bile. There are some great scenes, like I love watching Ewan McGregor and Johnny Lee Miller fight while trashing a bar. That sequence was great to watch. But there's a lot of stuff in here, too, where you just sort of feel, it does not feel, it feels old. It feels like old Trainspotting. Maybe that's the point, is it feels like that same thing, but it's lost its edge. It's lost a bit of its energy. Every now and again, you get these little awesome moments from Danny Boyle, and I wish there had been more of them. I won't say what it is, but I'll say the final shot of the film that leads into the end credits was awesome. Like, it's just such a simple little thing, but it's great. Or there's one part where Johnny Lee Miller and Ewan McGregor are ranting about British football, and the words they are saying are, like, filling up the screen as they spew out of their mouths. That stuff is cool. It's neat. Needed more of that, because when that stuff wasn't happening, it felt kind of old, man. But all in all, I enjoyed Trainspotting 2. I don't agree with any of the reviews that were claiming it was better than the original. But as a belated follow-up, at least it kind of justified its own existence. Like, at least I felt like there was a point to it, and I can definitely appreciate it like that. But I gotta tell you, I'm not gonna revisit this one. I'm gonna revisit the original Trainspotting.
I saw it myself, and I had the exact same thoughts you did. I thought it was surprisingly enjoyable, given that it was 20 years after the fact. I mean, it didn't really have, like, much of a plot, so to speak. It's kind of like, well, they start some crazy schemes, and Begbie gets out of prison, and he tries to get revenge on Renton, and that's about it. But it was cool to see these characters again 20 years later, just because it went in real time, and just kind of see how they'd evolved since then and learn a few new things about them. And they're such interesting characters that it was cool to spend some time with them. And like you said, there were some a couple of energetic moments that were kind of reminiscent of the original Trainspotting. But like you said, it didn't feel as fresh as it did way back in 1996. And the same thing happened with me. After I was done watching this, I felt compelled to watch the original film. But this one will not be an all-time keeper. It's a good way to spend 2 hours, but it's not an all-time classic.
Yeah, there's certainly no harm in double billing them. I would definitely say that. Like, if you have an inkling that you might want to watch Trainspotting 2, watch them back to back. Like, really get that time jump, and I'm sure it would be a very interesting thing to see. But the one that is, I mean, obviously Trainspotting is the superior. I also have to say, what a blessing that everybody involved in Trainspotting turned out to be such talent. Like, Danny Boyle is a good director, and all of the main cast all turned in, like, they continued to be great actors. So it's really cool. Like, Ewan McGregor's an awesome actor. I love Robert Carlyle. It's great to see them plying their trade with these characters again, and have them all on screen at the same time. So yeah, a bit of a mixed bag, but I did enjoy myself at least. And that is all I've been up to. So now, we're going to do a first for Shouts from the Back Row, which is we're going to do sort of a triple memorial episode. And initially, our plan for this episode was going to be a tribute to Michael Parks, because he is an actor who has had quite the long and storied career as a character actor, as a that guy. And if you listen to this show for any amount of time, you learn that we love character actors here. We love Hollywood that guys. But then we lost Powers Booth, another prolific character actor, and also an actor like Parks who started really rising to fame in like the 80s. I feel like the 80s and maybe like the late 80s, early 90s is when these guys who had been doing these bit parts forever have finally started really taking off. And then, you know, shortly after that, we also lost Sir Roger Moore. And Roger Moore, he had such an impressive filmography, but it's pretty clear that one role stood out over all the others. So I figured, you know what, we got to talk about all of these guys, and if we, you know, span it over the next month, it might not feel relevant anymore. Let's talk about all three of them. And so before we list, we're going to list our favorite role for each of them. So it's going to be like one of our usual top three episodes, but instead of our top three roles of any given actor, it's going to be our favorite role of these three actors. Before we get to our list, though, I wanted to just get some general thoughts about these guys, these gentlemen of cinema, from you two. So, TK, I know that you were saddened by Roger Moore's death. I feel like you've just always expressed a great delight at some of the James Bonds, like Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton. What do you think of Sir Roger Moore?
I really liked Moore as Bond, and like I used to watch his early stuff whenever he was. I used to watch repeats of The Saint when I was growing up. So like it's kind of funny. Like we have all these, like we had like Remington Steele and then like The Saint, and like they're all kind of like vaguely Bondish, and then they eventually go on to become Bond, which I find always really interesting. But I liked Moore played this like kind of goofy Bond. I'm a very big fan of, I have a very soft spot for Moonraker, even though it's not a great Bond movie. It's just, it's so weird. It's so like, whoa, they released Star Wars a couple years ago. Let's do something and send James Bond to space. let's do it with Roger Moore. it's weird.
Well, let's talk more about him as James Bond when we talk about our favorite of his roles, because I'm sure James Bond is unavoidable. It was without a doubt his most famous. But was it The Saint when you first became aware of Sir Roger Moore?
Yeah, absolutely. Watching reruns with my grandma when I was a kid. So.
And what about you, Robin? Was it James Bond?
Oh, yes, definitely. I never saw The Saint, but I'm probably a bigger Roger Moore fan than most James Bond fans, because I know sometimes his era of movies gets such a bad rap because they were so cartoonish and they were so goofy and stuff, but I thought he just played that material well because he had this really, like, dry, straightforward sense of humor and stuff, and I kind of do the comparison that it's like Sean Connery, as great a Bond as he was, would not have worked in those type of Bond vehicles. Moore just had the perfect deadpan comic timing to play those type of silly, like, Bond movies, and that's why I have a blast watching them.
And my first exposure to Roger Moore was, as well, James Bond. Like, it really is just the role that completely dominates his filmography. Like, I do know that he was on the TV series The Saint, but aside from a handful of, like, side roles or walk-on roles, for me, Roger Moore, just, it's James Bond all the way down. And I'm sure, like, I actually had some really interesting thoughts about Moore as James Bond, as I'm sure you guys do. So when we talk about our favorite roles of his, and I'm getting the feeling that we all know which is the one we're going to name, we can talk a bit more in depth about his portrayal of 007. Now, what about Powers Booth? TK, can you remember the first time you saw Powers Booth in something?
I'll be honest. I was going through his filmography, and, like, I remember him, but I can't attach anything to it. Like, I have a really hard time pinning him to a role. But the biggest one that I can remember, when as soon as I saw his face, I'm like, oh, he's Senator Rourke from Sin City. That's, like, the biggest thing that I can remember from him. And, like, I wish I tried to watch some clips and stuff. I just didn't have time this afternoon. But that's the only big thing I remember him from, really.
I bet I can remind you of another role that he is very memorable in, but we'll get to that later. Robin, what about you? Do you remember your first exposure to Powers Booth, to the power of Powers Booth?
I don't know the very first thing I saw of him, but the first thing that he made an impression on me on was one of my guilty pleasures, a Jean-Claude Van Damme sudden death. Action goes into overtime. It's essentially Die Hard. And, yeah, that's the catchphrase on the poster. It's Die Hard at Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final, where a bunch of terrorists take over, like, a hockey game and threaten to blow it up, and Van Damme plays the John McClane role, and Powers Booth plays the Hans Gruber role, and he just camps it up so much, and his plan doesn't make sense, because it's kind of like, I will blow, if you not deposit, like, the money I want in my account by the end of the hockey game, I will blow up the entire building, and then the Penguins at the last second score to send the game into overtime, and so he decides, well, the game's not over. I guess I can't blow up the building yet. Really doesn't make much sense, but it's such a goofy movie, and Booth is clearly having a blast. And he has a classic death scene where he tries to escape by helicopter, and the helicopter, like, goes through the retractable roof of the arena and crashes on the middle of the ice and stuff. It's just hilarious. So it's obviously not one of his best roles, but it's the first time he really made an impression on me.
You know, it's interesting. Besides James Bond, Roger Moore, I remember seeing him when I was younger in also a Jean-Claude Van Damme vehicle, that crappy tournament movie, The Quest. So there's a connection there. And Powers Booth, for me, well, guys, I would say I'm tipping my hand when I say the first time I became aware of him was definitely the movie Tombstone. But I have spoken so much about Tombstone lately, especially in our recent episode about the death of Bill Paxton as well. God, that's so damn sad. And Kurt Russell. We did an episode about Kurt Russell not that long ago. Tombstone is all over this. But you know what? Since then, I've actually added Tombstone to my personal pantheon on the site, which means it's off limits for making my lists just because I've been talking about it way too much. But in this case, I will say that the first time I really took notice of Powers Booth was as Curly Bill Brocious, the leader of the Cowboys in Tombstone. And to me, that role just sums up Powers Booth. He's got that gruff voice. He usually plays a menacing character. He's got that iconic look, a really wide jaw, these fierce eyes, and often a huge impressive mustache as well. And his role in Tombstone really features all of those things to a T. And now our third tribute is to Michael Parks. And this is a pretty interesting one, I think, because Michael Parks, he certainly had, as I mentioned, this very long career as a character actor, but much more recently, I'd say starting in the early 2000s, he really started to become known as like this go-to guy for some of our favorite filmmakers, such as Quentin Tarantino. And his career had a revival in a way. And also Kevin Smith. He's had a revival in a lot of Kevin Smith films. So, TK, do you remember the first time you became aware of Michael Parks?
Probably in any Earl McGraw role he played in all most of Tarantino's films, to be honest. So I guess From Dusk Till Dawn would be my earliest. Is that right? Am I crazy?
Yeah, that's the earliest role of him as Earl McGraw.
Yeah, Robin. but McGraw did a bunch of films. So I remember him from that. But his biggest impact was in the Kill Bill volumes 1 and 2, where he played two cross characters. Like he played McGraw, and then he played another guy named Enrique. In the second,
Esteban. As long as Esteban. You call me Esteban.
Thank you.
And Robin, what about you? Do you remember when the first time you took note of Michael Parks was?
Yes, and it was not the best movie. It was in Death Wish 5, The Face of Death, the last of the Death Wish series, which was made in the 90s, and it was shot in Toronto, and Charles Bronson was something like 70 in it, and this was thankfully the final Death Wish film, and he played the villain in it, and I remember he had a classic death scene where he's thrown into an acid bath, and Charles Bronson actually says to him, "You're very dirty. You need a bath," before tossing him in there.
God.
It was pretty bad, but it was not a role where he really made an impression in it. But I know I saw him in it, and it was shortly after that I saw From Dusk Till Dawn in his very brief role as Earl McGraw I started to take note of him.
Jeez, man. That's a dumb joke of the week material. For me, so when I first started to take note of Michael Parks, it was definitely From Dusk Till Dawn, because he has this amazing introductory scene where he's just given all the best Tarantino-esque dialogue that he can sink his teeth right into. And that role would go on to become like one of his more famous late career roles and was featured in multiple Tarantino and Rodriguez movies. But I actually probably noticed him before that when I watched Twin Peaks. And he has a pretty great role on Twin Peaks. And man, it's kind of sad that Twin Peaks, the return or the revival, whatever they're calling it, is on now, right as Michael Parks has passed away. So now let's get into our lists of our favorite roles. And I do feel like we've got some indication what a couple of these are going to be, because two out of the three of these men have very obvious iconic roles associated with their names. You know, I almost feel like, and I'm referring to, of course, Michael Parks and Roger Moore. We've already like name dropped two of their iconic roles. And it's interesting. I almost feel like there are fewer options with Roger Moore than there are with Michael Parks, even though Roger Moore was much more of a leading man. But let's talk about Sir Roger Moore first. And TK, I now pose the obvious question. You're going to blindside me if you don't pick it. It's your favorite Sir Roger Moore role is?
It's going to be James Bond in Moonraker. I'm sorry. It's great. It's a lot of fun to watch. He's funny. He's a perfectly Roger Moore Bond in this film. That's the best way I can describe it from there.
So why Moonraker out of all the James Bond films featuring Moore?
Like a lot of people will lean towards the one with Jaws, which is a lot of fun. But it's like I said, Moonraker. When you look at like the whole James Bond franchise, Moonraker is such a weird, it's a weirdly out of place film. And so I'm kind of attracted to it because of that. And again, because Moore is such a different Bond than Connery and Dalton and all that, it's just so odd to see him in this like really out of quote unquote out of world Bond film. And he does it the best he can with the material and the best he can with the script, and just I think he has a fun time doing it. And he knows it's campy and he knows it's silly, and I think that there's a certain respect you have to give for that.
It's interesting to me because I mean, that was what his fourth time playing Bond. Moonlight Dive. His fourth time playing Bond. It's interesting that you picked that one, and it sounds like it's mostly just because it's more of a wacky genre film than anything else. Like, why not Live and Let Die, TK? Why not the man with the golden gun, for that matter?
You're right. Him v. Christopher Lee is great, but just, I don't know, just something about Moonraker that just always kind of sits with me. Really, I think it's the laser.
I definitely would have actually thought the man with the golden gun just for Christopher Lee. Robin, what is your favorite Roger Moore role?
Well, my favorite technically is Bond, but I'm actually going to talk about another Roger Moore role that most people haven't heard of because it's one of his more unique ones. And it's a movie I've written a Robin's Underrated Gems column for, and the title of the movie is Folks. It's spelled F-F-O-L-K-E-S because he plays a character named Rufus Excalibur Foulkes, which is a great action hero name. I know in some places this movie was released under the title North Sea Hijack, but in other places it's released as Foulkes. But he made this movie while he's in the middle of playing James Bond. I think he made it in 1980. And one of the other reasons I'm naming it is because Michael Parks has a supporting role in it. This is a rare movie with Roger Moore and Michael Parks. In this one, he plays a character who is kind of an anti-James Bond because he's an action hero who absolutely hates women. Like, he's a complete misogynist, and he doesn't even like women sexually. He spends pretty much every one of his scenes, he's like complaining about how much he hates women. It's kind of a running gag in it. There's even a scene where he goes on a dangerous mission and asks them to write up his last will and testament and says, make sure it doesn't go to any of my female relatives. Make sure everything is left to my cats. And just seeing Roger Moore recite this material is quite hilarious. The plot of it involves Anthony Perkins playing leads a group of terrorists who takes over like a ship, and they plant a bunch of bombs on a bunch of oil rigs and threaten to blow them up if they are not paid a certain amount of money. And Moore's character Foulkes is like this anti-terrorist expert who has to launch a mission to rescue them. And Michael Parks plays Anthony Perkins' henchman, and James Mason plays the admiral who assigns Roger Moore the task and stuff. And it's got some action in it, and it's a kind of a suspenseful cat and mouse game. I kind of like the interplay between Roger Moore and Anthony Perkins. They spend a lot of time with each other, like sharing threats over the radio. And Michael Parks is really good. He kind of plays this nervous, jittery henchman and who doesn't know what he's doing most of the time and can snap at any moment. And I also kind of like the timeliness of it because they released this just as Margaret Thatcher was elected prime minister of Great Britain, and they kind of make that a running gag in the film that Moore's character has to take orders from the new prime minister, who's now a woman, and he's just so disgusted by that the woman is running the country. It adds to Cole's misogynistic character, yet in spite of this, he's strangely likable, even though he is kind of a grumpy misogynist curmudgeon, and it's kind of neat to see Moore kind of showing his range playing this kind of anti-James Bond action hero who's all business and doesn't care about women and stuff, and believe it or not, Moore actually says that this movie is better than any of the James Bond films he made. He considers this, I think, one of his favorite roles just because of how different it was. And it kind of gets to show him stretching his range and also show his great comic timing that served him well during his James Bond series. It's kind of forgotten about today, not really well known, but I think it's pretty underrated, and I think that all James Bond fans and Roger Moore fans should check it out because it's one of the hidden gems in his filmography.
I actually did want to check this out based on your Robin's underrated gems for it. I didn't have a chance, but I think one reason it might be forgotten today is that it has a whole bunch of alternate titles. Like, if you look for it on IMDb, you'll find it under the title of North Sea Hijack. So I kind of wonder if this is what... It's almost like a Live, Die, Repeat / Edge of Tomorrow situation where it went through different titles and made it hard to keep track of. But I definitely intend to watch this one because it does sound really interesting. So my favorite role for Sir Roger Moore is, of course, James Bond. It has to be James Bond. I guess I'd probably pick the man with the golden gun. But to me, I'm going to be perfectly frank. Roger Moore was never my favorite James Bond. And to me, the Roger Moore James Bond films all kind of blend together. You know, I guess Moonraker and Live and Let Die definitely have their own sort of flavor. Live and Let Die doing like the weird voodoo thing, which is kind of a strange, it's almost like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, but for James Bond. And then Moonraker, of course, is like the mock Star Wars thing. And boy, is it absolutely ridiculous. But what the thought that I had about Roger Moore as James Bond, that TK, you were touching on something interesting in the intro where you were saying, like, he's sort of like the goofy James Bond. I was thinking about it, and tell me if you guys agree. I think that Roger Moore is to James Bond what Adam West was to Batman. Huh?
It's true. Yes, I totally agree with that. They even look alike, technically, and they were just so... They're not the guys you would play to play the series version of the character, but for the type of role they were asked to play, they did, like, a brilliant job at playing up the camp and the humor of it.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, they were sort of like the disco era, and they were all the... In fact, if you even think of something like Live and Let Die, some of the villains are cartoonish to the point of being, like, out of the Adam West Batman. Like that henchman who has the metal, like, robotic pincher hand. He totally looks like a Batman villain. And I'm going to go on a little tangent here because I had that thought where I was like, he's like, you know, Roger Moore is to James Bond what Adam West is to Batman. And then I was like, I wonder if you can actually map those two series. And guess what? You totally can. So Roger Moore is the Adam West Batman. Sean Connery is the Michael Keaton Batman. Timothy Dalton is the Val Kilmer Batman. George Lazenby is the George Clooney Batman. Daniel Craig is Christian Bale. Huh?
Makes total sense.
On it. TK, you haven't chimed in. What do you think?
No, I'll buy those explanations. That sounds about right. I like Lazenby as the George Clooney Bond. I'll take that.
He totally is, though, isn't he?
So who's going to be the Ben Affleck Bond? That's what we need to see.
Whoever follows up Daniel Craig, I think. Because a lot of people seem to enjoy the Daniel Craig Bonds. Oh, but I've probably missed one in there. Who's the Pierce Brosnan Batman? I got to rethink this theory. Anyway,
Kilmer?
I thought Kilmer was Dalton, personally. We're going way off track. Anyway, that being said, another thing that I really appreciate about Roger Moore as James Bond, because he doesn't take the character too seriously and all of his outings were very goofy, is he's the James Bond that Austin Powers is parodying. Austin Powers is like the extreme version of the Roger Moore James Bond. I find that Roger Moore got a lot of, like, the most groan-worthy quips. I think it's in Live and Let Die where he's got a magnetic watch and he uses it to undo a woman's dress and he's like, animal magnetism, my dear. I think he had some of those,
yeah.
the most groan-worthy ones. And, like, he's the one who dresses up like a clown. It's just, he's by far the most ridiculous James Bond, but because of him, like, his influence on pop culture is absolutely undeniable, even though a lot of people think he's really silly, and you can see that reflected in something like Austin Powers, where it's, you know, disco James Bond, it's been done. It was absolutely a thing. Are there any other Roger Moore movies or roles that you guys want to mention? I only have one that really stood out to me, which is Cannonball Run. And that stood out to me because, of course, he's a bit player in it, but he's basically playing James Bond again. It's that same role under a different name. But what about you guys? TK, I bet I know one movie that you're going to mention, right?
Sorry, come again?
There's got to be one more Roger Moore movie that you want to mention, right? Right?
Yeah, Spice World.
Yeah, that's right.
I knew it.
He's like the mysterious guy on the phone. It's fantastic. I love it. Like, I don't even think he has a name. It's just like the director or something. It's fantastic. And he's in the film for, I think, like less than 3 minutes. And it's just totally worth it. Or I think it is.
Are there any others that you'd care to mention, Robin?
Well, for the record, I'll say that my favorite James Bond movie is Octopussy, and that's the one where he dresses as a clown, just because of how goofy it is. I consider it my favorites. I can't think of too many other roles, but I do want to mention that on one of my 42nd Street Forever trailer DVDs that I own, they show a trailer for a movie he made in the early 60s, which is a historical drama called The Rape of the Sabines, one of his earlier roles. And what's hilarious is that they say the title like 5 or 6 times, and that at the end they say the tagline, "Fun for the whole family." I'm like, wait a minute, what the hell?
I've seen that trailer, and not only is it hilarious, the fun for the whole family thing, but it's got one of those sort of stereotypical, almost transatlantic sounding trailer voices. So whenever they say the title, The Rape of the Sabines, you get it's like, The Rape of the Sabines, starring Roger Moore. It's The Rape of the Sabines, fun for the whole family. And of course, the trailer's on YouTube, so you can totally watch it.
Exactly. Never seen the movie, but I would recommend watching the trailer.
So now let's talk about Powers Booth. Just this such a memorable character actor. And for me, so much of Powers Booth, Powers Booth's power, if you will, is just like in his appearance. Because he has such a distinctive look. Like he has just such a... It's hard to like, I don't want to sound like I'm insulting the man, but he has such a distinctive look, and he has such a, like, a big wide face. Like, he is just this huge grin to him. It's like a lion's grin. It's so large, and he always has that, those dark eyebrows and a big, thick mustache that really accentuate sort of his bulldog features. And that distinctive look and that gruff persona is, for me, so much of what made him cool. So, TK,
probably the greatest name ever for an actor.
Yeah, Powers Booth too. Like that is a commanding name if ever there was one for a truly commanding guy. Now, TK, when we were discussing these guys earlier, just talking about our first impressions of them, you mentioned Senator Rourke, and you said you hadn't seen much else. So, is your favorite Powers Booth role Senator Rourke from Sin City?
Yeah, because I haven't had a chance to really catch him in as much. Like I said,
I
recognize
him. Tombstone, guys, come on.
Yeah, but I haven't seen Tombstone in like a decade, so like it's hard for me to pull stuff out from that.
You know, another great Michael Rooker role is in Tombstone as well. I might add that movie has everything, but I digress. I said I was going to remind you of another role that you've probably seen Powers Booth in that's really good. So I'll jump in here just before Robin and say, haven't you watched Deadwood? Didn't you watch Deadwood, TK?
No, I haven't seen an episode yet.
Why? You haven't seen Deadwood?
I know.
Powers Booth plays another awesome cowboy character, but different than Curly Bill Brocious from Tombstone, named Cy Tolliver, and he is just this criminal in the town of Deadwood who wants to have a casino and run a saloon and get rich that way. He's like a crook who's trying to go sort of the straight crooked route of having an official establishment for him to do his dirty dealings. And Ian McShane plays Al Swearengen, and another saloon, casino, brothel owner, and the two of them have this lengthy feud, this ongoing competition over whose saloon is the better saloon. And I have to say, it is just an absolute delight. Powers Booth is amazing as Cy Tolliver. He's obviously great at playing in westerns, and of course, Ian McShane as Al Swearengen is just Shakespearean in the way that he deals in profanity. Like, he spins the most vulgar sentences and makes them sound silky smooth. So, I mean, if you haven't seen Deadwood, you really need to check it out. It is a who's who roster of great actors who have all gone on to do much bigger things, from the lead role played by Timothy Oliphant. Stephen Tobolowsky is in it. John Hawkes is in it as well. It has absolutely everybody, and they are all fantastic. So you owe it to yourself to check out Deadwood if you haven't already, and you should probably check it out if you need another reason for Powers Booth as Cy Tolliver. Now, Robin, what about you? What's your favorite Powers Booth role? Is it Sudden Death?
No, it isn't, but it's one of my favorite films of his that he's made, actually, but I wouldn't call it his greatest role. My greatest role of his is something I didn't even watch, I think, until last year, and that was kind of his breakthrough role. It's called, it's a TV miniseries called Guyana Tragedy, The Story of Jim Jones, where Booth plays the infamous cult leader Jim Jones, who, as you know, led Jonestown and caused a mass suicide where like 900 people like drank some Kool-Aid and all took their own life. And this won him an Emmy back in 1980 and pretty much jump-started his career. And I had never seen this before. It's probably very hard to find, but you can watch it on YouTube. And he pretty much just blew me away in the role because he totally shows like why people were drawn in by Jim Jones, because like at the outset he looks like he's a good guy, who a humanitarian who wants to help people and stuff, and you can see how people can get enthralled with him and be convinced into joining his cult, but then you find out that he's just like a horrible, terrifying individual, and Booth exemplifies that so well, where he can be terrifying and charming at the same time, but you can see how people fall under his spell, and he's just phenomenal in the closing scenes where he's leading the mass suicide by giving the speeches how people have to drink this poison Kool-Aid and take their own life before the authorities come to get him and stuff, and you can see why people would like willingly do this, because he has held such a spell over him, and you wind up just hating Jim Jones so much. But Booth just does the role justice, and it was so great to see that even though this movie isn't well known today, that it like jump-started his career and he became like a solid character actor after this. But this is one of the rare roles where he plays a leading role, because he was mostly known as a character actor who did supporting roles, but this is a movie where he is pretty much the whole show.
You know, it's interesting. He may have been known as a character actor in supporting roles, but those supporting roles were so frequently leader characters, like figures of authority. Tombstone, he's the leader of the Cowboys, the biggest gang in the Old West. Sin City, he is Senator Rourke. He's, you know, a politician. He has this power. And Deadwood as well, like, he's the leader of a gang, he's the owner of a saloon, and he's this powerful player in the town of Tombstone. You even mentioned in, like, Sudden Death, where he's a terrorist leader. So, clearly, that authority, it translated into so many of his roles. I guess he had that commanding presence that one looks for in a character who is playing, like, a leader figure. So I regret that I haven't seen that movie, but it comes as no surprise to me that he won an award for playing Jim Jones, and that he made a very convincing Jim Jones, because the man is clearly someone who can lead. He can command authority.
It's true. He's got a great voice. I've always loved his voice. It's very authoritative.
Are there any other roles that you want to take note of? Like, TK, you said, you know, there were some minor things that you know you've seen him in. Is there anything else you want to note for Powers Booth? I feel like I got to wag my finger and shame you a bit for not knowing
No, wag away. Like I said, I've seen him in so much, but nothing's jumping at me. That's all. Just Sin City for me.
Robin, what about you? Other Powers Booth roles?
Well, I have to say with great sadness, his role as the FBI agent in the horror movie Frailty, which starred and directed by Bill Paxton, who just passed away last month. So that's two movies, this and Tombstone, which featured both actors who have died way too young, unfortunately. But I consider it an excellent and very underrated horror movie. And I hope Matthew McConaughey is going to do okay. I hope that the movie Frailty isn't jinxed right now.
Yeah, seriously, Frailty is in my little honorable mentions list for Powers Booth. And I just got such a pang of sadness thinking about how, you know, oh, Frailty, Bill Paxton, Powers Booth, and, oh, Tombstone, Bill Paxton and Powers Booth. And I even thought, like, oh, Alien Covenant is coming out. Oh, Bill Paxton. Oh, no. It's been a kind of a sad time for our favorite character actors.
It's so true.
Yeah, Tombstone and Frailty are the other ones that I have noted down here. But I suppose it is worth mentioning, even though I don't really watch it anymore, Powers Booth played a sizable role on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. for at least one season. He even has a cameo in the movie The Avengers, but it's just like his silhouette in shadow as the leader of, I forget what the organization is called. I guess it's S.H.I.E.L.D., but like the people who command S.H.I.E.L.D., he's like the shadow government leader. And of course, in the Avengers, all you hear is that distinctive voice of his. One last thing I want to note about Powers Booth, too, that I found funny is when I was researching his filmography, I noticed that there's like a rumor that he has a cameo off screen as a voice in Con Air.
Yes, I've seen that movie, and the opening narration is an Army Ranger announcing that Nicolas Cage has graduated Army Ranger training, and it does sound a lot like him, but it has never been confirmed if it's actually him or not, but I think it's him.
I want to believe. And then finally... go ahead.
Oh, I also wanted to mention that two other roles he played is he was actually a frequent actor used by Walter Hill during the 1980s, and he starred in two underrated action films, Southern Comfort and Extreme Prejudice. And I love his role in Extreme Prejudice because he plays the villain who goes one-on-one in a shootout with Nick Nolte. And this movie is almost like the character actor Expendables because Booth's character has a gang of bad guys who are played by characters who are often playing action movies villains. So you get to see Powers Booth lead Michael Ironside, William Forsythe, and Clancy Brown. It's character actor Nirvana, that movie.
Jeez, I gotta watch that one. Wow.
It's an excellent action movie.
And then finally, let's talk about Michael Parks, who, as I noted previously, has had such an interesting sort of career revival as these more niche directors, these 90s video store self-taught auteur directors had brought back his career in a really big way. People like, of course, Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino, and Kevin Smith. And this is another guy who, I guess, he owed a lot to that career resurgence because the role that really brought him back in the spotlight is one that he carried through multiple films in the Tarantino-Rodriguez movie universe. And it's the one that TK mentioned up at the top, Texas Ranger Earl McGraw. So TK, I ask you, is your favorite Michael Parks role Texas Ranger Earl McGraw?
No, it's not. My favorite Michael Parks role is his role as the preacher in Red State, which I assume is your guys as well.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Gil?
Aben Cooper?
Yeah.
You know, I had this feeling that you guys would pick Aben Cooper from Red State, but I wanted to go with Texas Ranger Earl McGraw. I find that to be the more iconic role, even though Red State is probably the better meteor role for him. But I figured we'd just end up talking about both of them anyway. So TK, give us your thoughts on his character in Red State in general. What do you think of him in that film?
I know we've talked about Red State, not extensively, but we've covered it a few times on the podcast here. I think the thing that Parks does in this is he just makes Cooper so... you really believe that Cooper is fully into whatever he's pushing. He really believes in all the end of world stuff. He believes that what him and the church are doing are righteous and sanctioned. And you really get that cult of personality that's built up with him. And I can't think of another actor that could have done it that way. Everyone's entranced by him when he's talking. And I feel that that's the, And Parks is just so kind of commanding in that league, and it's very hard to think of anyone who could pull that type of charisma and kind of pull that type of charisma with that background of horror, because you realize how off the wall he is, but how perfectly stable he appears. He's brilliant in it. I just thought that's fantastic. And Red State is an amazing, amazing.
I can think of an actor. I can think of another actor who could play that role, who could command an entire cult and own every scene he was in. Powers Booth!
Yeah! They should have done the crossover movie.
But I definitely agree that Michael Parks is just phenomenal in Red State. I haven't revisited the film. It was one of my favorites of the year that it came out. And I always thought it was such an interesting dalliance for Kevin Smith away from stoner comedies or even just relationship dramas to do something that was a lot more horror thriller, a more extreme kind of a film. And I remember hoping that Kevin Smith would do more like that, but sadly he really hasn't. But we still have Red State to thank for giving Michael Parks, I think that dude deserved an Oscar, at least an Oscar nomination for that monologue that he gives where he just completely owns the scene, and it goes on for 10 minutes straight of him just monologuing, but I was riveted for every minute of it. Robin, what do you think of Michael Parks in Red State?
Oh, yeah, he's just phenomenal in it and pretty much makes the entire movie. And I always love this line he gives because the cult in this, the religious cult, is so obviously inspired by Fred Phelps in the Westboro Baptist Church. And someone in an interview asked Parks, like, was your performance inspired by Fred Phelps? And he was like, are you kidding? Have you actually heard Fred Phelps talk? He's boring, man, which I thought was the best ultimate burn. And he said that the way he approached the role is to do the exact opposite of Fred Phelps and actually make the character interesting. And that's what he does. He gives these long, long sermons and monologues, which could potentially be boring because they drag on for a long time, but he is just riveting to watch. And like you said, the terrifying thing about him is that he legitimately believes a lot of the stuff that he's spewing and that what he's doing is right and that he's preparing for like the apocalypse and stuff. And then there's that brief moment at the end of the movie where it looks like he might actually be right and that the apocalypse is going to hit. But then it turns out that it's all fake. And then I love the last scene of him like in a jail cell at like kind of like a Guantanamo-like facility where he's being held as a terrorist and he's singing those like songs about Jesus. And then it ends with like Kevin Smith's voice in the cell next door saying, shut the fuck up! And then it cuts to the end credits. I think it's a great ending to the movie to show the character's downfall and stuff. But yeah, I really wish that he had gotten an Oscar nomination for it, but I don't think these are the type of films that get Oscar coverage.
Certainly not. But yeah, it really is just a sight to behold, that film. It's really quite amazing to watch him command those scenes and make it that engaging. That's the scary thing, is that it's engaging. Oh man. But for my pick, I had to go with Texas Ranger Earl McGraw because I just find this character so interesting. This character who was brought back again and again over multiple films, starting with, of course, From Dusk Till Dawn, and then he came back in Kill Bill films. He was back in Death Proof and Planet Terror, actually, these both films in Grindhouse. And then he even came back as, like, I think he was a descendant of Earl McGraw, or just a different role called Amber. He's just like a different role in From Dusk Till Dawn 3. He had two roles in Kill Bill Volume 2. It was clear that Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino just loved this guy. And, but, you know, Earl McGraw, I just think is such a good role for him. This take no shit sheriff, or rather Texas Ranger. He gets all these great lines, and he's so gruff, you know. He's the very image of that gruff Texas Ranger, like highway cop with his aviator sunglasses, and he's always got those like turns of phrase, like when he finds the bride in Kill Bill and it looks like she's dead, he says, this tall drink of cocksucker ain't dead. Like, who says that, man? And not only who says that, but who can make a line like that work so well? Like, it's just off the cuff. It's got to be Michael Parks. And it's also, I also find it really neat that his son plays the son of Earl McGraw in almost all of these movies. Like, I think he turns up in From Dusk Till Dawns, and he certainly plays him in Kill Bill. It's kind of funny, this, like, mini movie universe with the McGraws that turned up as a background through line for all of these Tarantino and Rodriguez movies. What do you guys think of Texas Ranger Earl McGraw?
I find it so fascinating that this one character who's in the first 5 minutes of From Dusk Till Dawn and gets killed off immediately somehow spawned this, like, cult following and like inspired the McGraw universe, where the character like keeps coming back in all these multiple movies, and how Michael Parks' real life son James Parks played Edgar McGraw in From Dusk Till Dawn 2, and then they both came back in Kill Bill 1, and then you we're introduced to like Earl McGraw's daughter in Grindhouse and stuff. So it's, but I think, I don't think he would have spurned this cult following if he wasn't so great in that one scene in From Dusk Till Dawn where he just gives this monologue about catching like the Gecko brothers and stuff. And he has such colorful dialogue that he pretty much steals the scene. And I think that's what made Tarantino and Rodriguez think, we got to bring this guy back. We got to bring this character back. He's so fascinating. So, and I kind of like the timeline that there's a, kind of a fan theory that after his scene in Kill Bill movies that maybe Earl just left the church, the crime scene, and then went to this liquor store, and that's where he got killed off. If you try to follow the timeline, it's kind of fascinating to look at it and stuff. But it's kind of interesting that his role in From Dusk Till Dawn, this very small role, kind of resurrected his career because it made Tarantino and Rodriguez keep wanting to bring him back, and that's why he kept getting all these great roles so late in his career.
I mean, it's arguably the best scene in the movie, too. It's like this, it's its own short film, and it features freaking John Hawks again, second time he gets mentioned. It's, all of it is very memorable and really fun. And as a side note, I also love that the like father son thing has also been ongoing through all of these films. Like both he and James Parks had small roles in Django Unchained. James Parks arguably played the best character in Hateful Eight, OB, the stagecoach driver. It's so cool to have the Parks-averse running alongside the Tarantino and Rodriguez-averse. TK, what do you think of Texas Ranger Earl McGraw?
He's a fun character, and I like the consistency of him, like always popping up in films. I think it's like you were just saying, the word escaped me.
The McGrawniverse?
The McGrawniverse, sorry. I don't know how did I forget that? I think it's just such an interesting concept. I like when directors do something like that, like have something consistent, and Parks is a perfect person to play someone like that, I think, because he's very distinctive. He has a very distinct look and a very distinct way of talking, and I think it's kind of fun to pop that up every once in a while.
And what about...
My favorite line of his is, he's more useless than a pecker on a pope. Who else but Michael Parks can make that line work?
Amazing, yeah. They just gave him... They clearly loved this guy's work. I suppose it's not a surprise since he was working like all through the 70s and 80s, those eras that no doubt inspired Tarantino and Rodriguez the most. But, yeah, I mean, Michael Parks is just great in all of those movies. What about other roles that you find noteworthy of his? TK, is there anything else that you really enjoyed Michael Parks in?
Hang on, what else did I enjoy? I liked him in Bloodfather, which is a Mel Gibson movie I watched last year that I really enjoyed. He plays this weapons dealer who was friends with Gibson, and he double-crosses him at the last second, and he's just such a slimeball, and Parks is just, again, perfect to play a role like that. Like, just perfectly despicable.
Yeah, that's another really good one for him. I was pleasantly surprised to see him pop up there. Robin, are there any other roles for Michael Parks that you want to note?
Surprisingly, I haven't seen a lot of his early stuff that I know Tarantino and Rodriguez were fans of, so I'm kind of anxious to go back and see that at some point. But the other role I wanted to talk about, of course, is Tusk, which is a very flawed movie, of course, but Michael Parks, the undeniable strength of that movie. Like, his performance is great. Like, that he can get such poignancy out of a guy who wants to convert, like, a person into a walrus is just kind of remarkable, and it's kind of like, if he wasn't in this movie, it would probably be unwatchable, but he still manages to deliver like a great performance in a movie that's really, really stupid.
Yeah, he's really the only reason to watch Tusk, in my opinion. And what's so interesting about him in that movie is, you know, not only does he actually, like, he plays a character, he doesn't just go like, oh, I'm in a movie about a man who wants to turn Justin Long into a walrus, why? Like, he doesn't phone it in. He really commits to that role. But, I love that spoilers for Tusk, I love that the whole thing culminates in him fighting Justin Long while the two of them wear walrus costumes, and it's so ridiculous, but man, like, he was still scary, I didn't doubt Michael Parks in that role, so, Yeah, I mean, Tusk is in my honorable mentions as well. I can't remember. TK, did you see Tusk?
Oh, yeah, I saw Tusk, and I wish I had that time back.
Oh, but,
I know. It's not a great movie, but Parks is, again, delightfully weird and creepy, except that single scene he gets with Johnny Depp, which is like the stupidest thing I think I've ever seen in a Kevin Smith film. Again, he's a perfectly calm madman, and I think that's fun to watch, and I think Smith does a really good job drawing that out over the course of the film. But you're right, that climax of him and Justin Long fighting each other is just ridiculous.
And besides that, I also have to mention again Twin Peaks. He was really great in Twin Peaks, and while I was doing research on Michael Parks, I stumbled upon his character biography from Twin Peaks on IMDb, and I thought this was extremely well written. So if you haven't seen Twin Peaks, Michael Parks plays Jean Renault, a dangerously cool Canadian mobster and extortionist, fiercely hateful of Agent Cooper. He runs gambling, drug smuggling, racketeering, prostitution, and more in the Northern Territories. Dangerously cool Canadian
Jean
mobster.
Renault, is it? Jean Renault, is it spelled the same as the actor?
No, it's Jean, the same way, J-E-A-N, but Renault as in R-E-N-A-U-L-T, because of course it's Canadian.
Oh, okay.
It's French-Canadian, Renault. So, yeah, Michael Parks in Twin Peaks, he has some really excellent lines like, candy is dandy, ain't it? And it's such a good role for him. Shame that he did not return for the new Twin Peaks. So do we have any final thoughts now that we've sort of looked at these three very different careers, but we found a lot of commonalities, especially we almost played sort of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with these guys, but how they all kind of worked with all these other people that we've talked about on recent episodes, or, you know, multiples of them have worked with, Powers Booth and Michael Parks have both had very memorable, roles with John Hawks, things like that. Do you have any thoughts on these three careers as we now lay them to rest?
Well, it particularly makes me sad that Roger Moore died, because I know he was 89, but it's like he's technically the first Bond to die, because all the other Bonds are still alive at this point, so it is kind of sad to see our first 007 pass away.
It's very true, and you know, I really wish, I know that in Skyfall there was a role, groundskeeper of the Bond family estate, played by Albert Finney, and I remember that the filmmakers, Sam Mendes, really wanted Sean Connery to play that role as sort of like a passing of the torch kind of a thing. And Connery passed because he's retired. I have to say, I'm kind of disappointed they didn't get Roger Moore. It would have been great. Why not just put Roger Moore in there? It's sad that he didn't get one last, like, swan song, one last blast in the James Bond role. Because for all that he is regarded as the silly James Bond, he definitely left his mark. Hey, TK, do you have any final thoughts on Roger Moore?
Oh, again, just sad that it's the first Bond to go, so, yeah. Who else is going to dress as a clown in a spy movie?
Robin, I cut you off
there.
What were you going to say?
Oh, no, I didn't say anything. I said I agree with your assessment that Roger Moore should have had a cameo.
Really should have, yeah. And Powers Booth and Michael Parks, in my opinion, they were just too very, very good. Two fantastic character actors. And it's especially disappointing for me that Michael Parks is gone now, because I wanted more of him in Tarantino and Kevin Smith films, because these directors were giving him just such cool roles, really awesome and interesting parts where he could bring that intensity to them and show off his acting chops. Like Kill Bill Volume 2, if you didn't know better, you probably would have no idea that Earl McGraw and Esteban Viejo were played by the same guy. Parks had such range. And Powers Booth, of course, was just terrifying, always.
It's also interesting that Parks, because of the basis of all these roles he was getting, actually got a very small role in Argo. I can barely remember the role because he isn't on screen that much, but it was kind of cool to see him get a cameo in an Academy Award-winning film.
Yeah, he plays a makeup artist. And Kevin Smith, on one of his podcasts, actually had a funny comment about that, which is he saw an early screening of Argo, because, of course, he's friends with Ben Affleck, And as he was watching it, he thought, my God, Ben Affleck stole most of the cast of Red State. Because, of course, John Goodman is also in Argo. And a lot of the other character, the other actors have very small roles like Michael Parks. So, rest in peace, Sir Roger Moore, Michael Parks, Powers Booth. All three of you will be missed. And your iconic roles will certainly live on for many years to come. And with that, it's time to play the Ticket Price is Right box office prediction game, where we try to predict the opening weekend box office numbers of movies being released this week. We also look back on last week's predictions. We've been off for a week, so we missed Alien Covenant. We've actually been, just by sheer happenstance, missing a lot of the really big ones that have come out this summer. Like, we missed predicting for Guardians of the Galaxy 2 because we had to skip that podcast. But now, last time we predicted the opening totals for King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, and Snatched, the Goldie Hawn, Amy Schumer film. And as I said on our last episode, I find it pretty great that both Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn have movies out right now, which is, I mean, who'd have thunk it? It's kind of awesome. So, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, well, guess who won this one? It was TK again. And, like, bang on the money, TK. You said it would make $15 million. It made $15.3 million. It's a way to go.
Hooray!
How did you do that? And then the winner for Snatched was actually me. I said it would make $20 million. It made $19 million. But I'm still trailing. TK, you have 12 points. I have 7, and Robin has 5. I still don't know what to make of this. This has never happened before, guys.
It's a weird topsy-turvy world, guys.
It's true. I'm too famous now to give accurate box office predictions.
His groove is gone. He poured his mojo into something else, and now he can't predict the opening totals in this meaningless game that we play. Well, this time, we do have a big blockbuster to predict. I'm happy. We're full on into, like, the summer blockbuster season at this point. And Pirates of the Caribbean 5, Dead Men Tell No Tales, a.k.a. Salazar's Revenge, is coming out. Oh, my God. Are these still going? Like, is anybody lining up for this? I can't muster the enthusiasm, I'm afraid. Did anybody want this, guys?
No. The last one was just so bad that I thought it was going to kill this franchise for good. But Johnny Depp has had a lot of flops the last few years, so I guess he's desperate.
Well, somebody believes in it because it has a budget of $230 million.
Oh my God.
God, so much money. TK, is Pirates of the Caribbean Dead Men Tell No Chests going to do very well on its opening weekend? What do you think?
It's going to make, like, let's go $30 million. I don't know. I think people have enough nostalgia for the Pirates movies, and, like, no matter how bad they are, they're going to enjoy watching Johnny Depp run around be stupid. That's what I think.
So even though $30 million is usually a respectable opening night or opening weekend for a lower budget film, you think it's going to bomb. You think it's going to tank.
Yeah.
Robin, how much do you think it'll make?
I'll go a little higher. I'll go with $35 million, but I don't have a feeling that there's going to be a big audience for this, and that, considering the budget, it's going to flop.
So, I think you guys are thinking pretty small on this one. I was originally going to go really high, but instead, I'm just going to, like, come along and squash you. I'm just going to put a little cap on it and say $40 million with the high bid, in all honesty, I think it's probably going to make a lot of money. I think it's going to make, like, $75 million opening weekend, just because, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, the fourth one, we all laugh at that movie and say it was terrible. It made $1 billion worldwide. These movies are still stupidly popular. So wow. I think it's actually going to do gangbusters. And then the other movie coming out this week, which I think is probably the far superior film in terms of quality, oddly enough, is Baywatch, the sort of 21 Jump Street-esque comedy revival a movie version of like an 80s or 90s TV show that was just known for being fluffy and stupid. And yet, this movie actually looks pretty funny, starring The Rock and Zac Efron and Alexandra Daddario. It has a budget of, like, do you think this is intentional? It has a budget of $69 million. Such an oddly wow. specific number, right, for a raunchy comedy. TK, how well will Baywatch do?
Like, I think 15.
15 million? Robin, what do you think?
It's too bad. I was kind of looking forward to this, but the reviews for it have been awful, so I'm going to go, I'll go with 20, but I don't think it's going to have much staying power.
I'm going to go higher. I think you guys are underestimating the box office draw of The Rock in this case. I'm going to say $30 million for Baywatch. I actually think it's going to do okay. But we'll see. We're getting into some real gamble territory here. Like Alien Covenant, even though we took that week off, it had a really sort of like lumpy opening weekend. It did really well on its opening night, and then word of mouth quickly spread that it wasn't so good, and then it started just like sinking very quickly. So I'll be curious to see how something like Pirates of the Caribbean does, where clearly there is a demand for it. Part four made a lot of money, but I think everybody's just sick of sequels at this point, especially ones that don't really justify themselves. I was talking about this with Trainspotting. Justify your sequels, guys. Come up with a good story. Now it is time for the dumb joke of the week. I caught a spider, and my wife told me to take it out instead of killing it. So we went out and had a few drinks. He's a nice guy. He wants to be a web designer. Yeah, boy. Yeah. And this is the part of the show where TK just leaves, and we don't hear from him again, as he sighs and makes grumbly noises. But if you want to get in touch with him, you can do so at the back row. You can contact TK by emailing tk@the-back-row.com. And Robin, of course, can be reached by emailing robin.warder@the-back-row.com. You should be sure to check out The Trail Went Cold at trailwentcold.com, Robin's weekly true crime podcast that I edit and produce. Robin is going to be at CrimeCon promoting The Trail Went Cold in Indianapolis on June 5th, was it, Robin?
June 9th to the 11th.
9th to the 11th. I got that completely wrong. June 9th to the 11th. Be sure to drop into CrimeCon if you're in the Indianapolis area and say hi to everybody's favorite true crime podcaster, the nicest voice in true crime podcasting, Robin Warder. And, of course, Robin also has Robin's Underrated Gems. You can read about Folks, the role that he picked for his favorite Roger Moore performance. And, of course, before there were stars, lots of clips of famous people before they were famous. And you can read a lot of his writing on Cracked.com and Listverse.com as well. Robin is by far the most prolific online person on this podcast.
Yeah. And the entire internet!
And the entire internet. And if you want to find all of the projects that I'm involved with, go to the-back-row.com. You can email me at gil@the-back-row.com. And you can find links to The Trail Went Cold, to my personal video portfolio. It showcases my video editing work. A whole lot of other stuff, other podcast projects that I've been involved with. It's all there. The-back-row.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Shouts from the Back Row is part of the Back Row Podcast Network. Visit the-back-row.com for more. The Shouts from the Back Row theme is composed by Vince Nitro. We'll